The following program is not a production of Audio Journal. External programs like this are selected with the interests of our audience in mind and with the goal to inform and entertain. The opinions expressed in this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. Thank you for listening to Audio Journal.
Hello, and welcome to the Women's Hour. I'm Mary Ellen. Thank you for joining me. Beginning today with the BBC. A mayor in Japan announced her maternity leave and got the whole country talking. By Kurumi Mori. When the mayor of a small town in western Japan announced she was taking maternity leave, she expected some raised eyebrows, but the reaction was far stronger and more divided than Shoko Kawata had ever anticipated. The 35-year-old has been plunged into a national debate about whether elected officials should take time off for childbirth in a country that's struggling to lift birth rates. I was so surprised because the reaction was so big, Kawata tells the BBC. Sitting on a blocky, cushioned armchair, she's flanked by two older men, her deputies, in a fifth-floor meeting room at City Hall in Yawata, a town south of Kyoto, known for its shrines and cherry trees. As there is currently no legal framework for local elected officials to take time off when they have babies, Kawata won't be taking maternity leave officially. Instead, she is assigning the man on her left, Shigeto Nose, to temporarily carry out her role. She laid out her plans at a news conference in May, where she said she'd be off 2 months before and 2 months after her mid-September due date. She will be making history as Japan's first ever mayor to take maternity leave. Everyone at work, where the average age is 39, was supportive, she says. But that wasn't the case among members of the public, who've expressed varying views in thousands of X posts and several YouTube videos. Some say having a baby is tough, and Kawata is doing her best. Japanese society has failed to design systems with pregnancy in mind, one claims. Another says Kawata is setting a wonderful example by putting her family first and making it easier for other women to enter politics. But critics argue that stepping away from public duties is irresponsible. And if she wanted to get pregnant, she should have done so before taking office. One says top officials wanting to take extended leave should resign. Others insist salaries should be cut during maternity leave. Kawata has brushed off the criticisms, proudly declaring she enjoys her job and believes now is the time for her to have a child and start a family. If we were to criticize politicians taking maternity leave, it means we are effectively excluding all women in their 20s through 40s, women who are capable of becoming pregnant, from public office. Shinji Ishimaru, the former mayor of Akitakata City in the Hiroshima Prefecture, believes the real issue is figuring out how to make sure duties are carried out during maternity leave. People agree maternity leave is good, he suggests on his YouTube channel, but he wants this case to spark a constructive discussion on finding a solution that doesn't disrupt municipal work. Kawata became Japan's youngest ever female city mayor, aged 33. She graduated from Kyoto University with a degree in economics before pursuing a career in local government and politics. She enjoys tea ceremonies, wearing kimonos, and visiting shrines and temples, according to her official profile page. And she's risen through the ranks in a very male political scene. As of last year, only about 4% of Japan's 1,720 municipal leaders were women. While the country may now have its first female prime minister, the government has regularly come under fire for not doing enough to encourage more women into politics. Some say the male-dominated cabinet and ruling Liberal Democratic Party, LDP, which has governed Japan for much of its post-war history, are part of the problem. A cabinet office survey released in July 2025 identified several barriers preventing women from entering politics. Pregnancy, an assumption politics is a man's job, and harassment. Japan is the world's fourth largest economy, but consistently ranks low on the gender gap index. In the most recent report released by the World Economic Forum in June 2025, Japan ranked 118th out of 146 countries. It is the worst performing G7 nation when it comes to gender equality. Although there is statutory maternity and paternity leave, which guarantees time off and partial income compensation, not everyone takes it. Women can get 6 weeks before their due date and 8 weeks after giving birth. Fathers get up to 4 weeks of flexible paid leave within 8 weeks of a child's birth. Both parents are also entitled to child care leave until the child turns one, during which eligible employees receive 67% of their wages for the first 180 days and 50% thereafter. Since April 2025, some parents can receive more support for the first 28 days if both parents take leave. I do think many people are watching to see how situations like this, when a woman gives birth while serving as a mayor, can be handled in practice. Deputy Mayor Shigeto Nose says, the 62-year-old father of two is set to exercise all mayoral authority during Kawata's absence, discussing major matters with her remotely once a week. He never took any parental leave himself and left virtually all of the child care to his wife. When I came home, I was tired. Even if the baby cried during the night, I left it to my wife. Looking back now, I genuinely feel that's something I should reflect on. Now, his son-in-law is taking 6 months off work to help his daughter take care of their second child. Seeing that makes me happy. Times have really changed, and it's great to see them working together like that. Kawata says, part of the criticism against her stems from the strongly held belief that those in certain positions, like public office, must abandon their private life and devote themselves entirely to the people. When asked what her future child will think about the attention surrounding her pregnancy, she says, I hope they will be surprised. I think we really need to create a society where it's so common for women to do both and not have to choose between working and having a family. From the New York Times, America, one line at a time. The only question left to be settled now is, are women persons? Susan B. Anthony, 1873. Does all men are created equal mean everyone? By Parul Segal. On November 5th, 1872, in Rochester, New York, 15 American women left their homes to commit a crime. Their leader, a woman in her 50s, with a famously cool, unwavering gaze, was arrested later that month. She denied nothing, and in a statement to the judge at her trial the following year, exhorted other women to join her. Do precisely as I have done. Rebel against your man-made, unjust, unconstitutional forms of law. The arrest of that leader, Susan B. Anthony, for casting a ballot, worked precisely as she and her fellow suffragists had intended, generating publicity and a test case for their movement. Anthony went on a speaking tour before the trial, declaring that the time for patience was over. She quoted from the 14th Amendment, enjoining her listeners to scrutinize its language and its logic, and then she put things quite simply. The sentence is blunt and bracing. The last word especially catches the ear. Anthony says persons rather than people because she's using the precise terms of the Constitution. All persons, born or naturalized in the United States, are subject to the jurisdiction thereof, are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States. If women like Anthony were persons, then they were also citizens. And if they were citizens, then no state laws, such as New York's, should abridge their privileges or immunities, such as the right to vote. This was a crucial point in the case Anthony was making, but it had much broader ramifications. The fight for women's suffrage was one of the longest and toughest in American history. It met ferocious opposition from liquor lobbyists who feared that newly enfranchised women would vote for prohibition, from industrialists who believed that they would argue for child labor laws, and from anti-suffrage women themselves, a large and mighty constituency. Are women persons? The judge in Anthony's case acknowledged that they were citizens, but he ruled that voting was not one of the privileges or immunities of U.S. citizenship. He directed the jury to find her guilty. Even so, the ruling hardly settled the question. Suffragists attacked it from various angles. In the early 20th century, the novelist Alice Duer Miller published a satirical suffrage column and a book called Are Women People? In a famous speech from 1851, Sojourner Truth spoke out, "I have plowed and reaped and husked and chopped and mowed, and can any man do more than that? I have heard much about the sexes being equal. I can carry as much as any man, and can eat as much, too." The suffrage movement played out in the streets, through public protests and hunger strikes, but also through the shrewd, close reading of America's founding documents. Suffragists became experts on how language holds and reveals social hypocrisies. In the speeches Anthony gave before her trial, she pointed out that the Federal Enforcement Act of 1870, which she had so proudly violated, exclusively used masculine pronouns, as did the printed forms pertaining to her case. The record of her conviction would have to be amended by hand, an S jotted beside he to make it into she, and so on. She said, "I insist, if government officials may thus manipulate the pronouns, to tax, fine, imprison, and hang women, women may take the same liberty with them to secure themselves the right to a voice in the government." She invoked New York tax laws that referred only to he, him, and his, and yet weren't taxes collected from women? The suffrage movement appropriated the great credo of the American Revolution: no taxation without representation, and pointed out that American women had continued to pay taxes without any say in the laws that governed their lives. Perhaps the most famous example of this kind of rereading occurred on July 19, 1848, when a group gathered to discuss the social, civil, and religious condition of women at what became known as the Seneca Falls Convention. Elizabeth Cady Stanton and others drafted a Declaration of Sentiments, which rewrote the central argument of the Declaration of Independence: all men and women are created equal. Suffragists were keenly conscious of making history in the moment. Anthony and Stanton kept extensive archives. Anthony's own collection threatened to collapse the attic of her home, and they produced a contemporaneous account of their tactics and triumphs in what grew to be the 6-volume History of Woman Suffrage, published between 1881 and 1922. In the century since, Scholars have shown how much that official narrative omitted and obscured. It neglected the contributions of rival feminist factions and of black suffragists, and it ignored how a movement that grew out of abolitionism tipped into racism as Stanton rallied against black men getting the vote before white women. A larger, more expansive story can be told. Rather than holding Seneca Falls as our starting point, we might recognize other, earlier milestones. For instance, when Maria W. Stewart, a black activist, became one of the first American women to speak out about politics and women's rights to mixed audiences at her public lectures in the 1830s. We must acknowledge that the ratification of the 19th Amendment in 1920 mainly enfranchised white women. Many black, indigenous, and immigrant women would be denied for years or decades. For them, the Voting Rights Act of 1965 was the more meaningful legislation. A wider aperture allows us to see not only concealed divisions, but also profound continuities. The suffrage movement had powerful bonds with other social causes, even global ones. It nurtured three generations of activists. One of Anthony's most popular speeches in the 1870s was, "Woman wants bread, not the ballot." Her case for appealing to women as a laboring class. They lobbied for married women to inherit property, to petition for divorce, to have custody of their children, to speak in public. The mark of personhood for Anthony and others was not granted by the vote, but exercised through it, the freedom and ability to make meaningful choices. Suffragists reread the story of American independence, poring over our founding documents and litigating the assumptions lodged in his words as simple as person. Historians continue their work, conducting their own scrupulous critique of the documents and narratives passed down. For this young country, the obligation and opportunity to revise has been our steadiest inheritance, a bequest of the Constitution itself, with its famous invocation of a more perfect union, reminding us that we are ever a work in progress, ever evolving. From the Boston Globe magazine, Connections. I never wanted to be a single mom. Then Everything Changed, by Jacqueline Renier. I never desperately wanted kids. I'd always loved being around them, babysitting, volunteering with Big Brothers Big Sisters, becoming auntie to my friends' children. But without a partner, I had no desire to parent alone. I lived in Brooklyn, traveled the world for work and fun. I had a close family and a circle of friends that felt like family. My life felt full. Then things shifted. A dear friend died from cancer. My brother and his wife announced they were expecting and left the city. I needed a change. I quit my job and moved back to Boston, pausing for the first time in my adult life. I craved purpose. After reading about Boston CASA, a nonprofit that trains volunteers to advocate for children in foster care who have experienced abuse or neglect, I applied. The statistics floored me. Kids in foster care who age out of the system are about 6 times more likely to experience homelessness. They are far less likely to graduate high school, and only about 1 in 10 goes on to earn a post-secondary degree, compared with half of the general population. 35 hours of training later, I was sworn in as a court-appointed special advocate and matched with an infant who had been exposed to fentanyl. It was terrifying and overwhelming, but the case resolved more quickly than expected. My second case was a 4-year-old living with her late mother's cousin. To protect her privacy, I'm not using her name. I visited every other week. We played Candyland, made crafts, and drew sidewalk art. Behind the scenes, I talked to her preschool teacher, monitored medical milestones, recommended speech and play therapy, and wrote reports for the judge. My role was to provide an objective account of her life and advocate for what she needed to thrive. As our bond deepened, she was moved to a new home, and then another. When I showed up to her third home in 7 months, she ran to me, asking, "How did you find me?" My heart split open. I started visiting weekly. This small girl was floating through the world with little to anchor her. I told my mom. Through tears, she replied, "We have so much love to give. You should adopt her." It felt absurd. I was single and traveling again for my new full-time job. But the seed was planted. A few months later, she became legally available for adoption. On Mother's Day 2021, I told my family I was considering adopting her. My dad said, "I knew it." My brother beamed. My sister-in-law teared up. Mom was so overjoyed. We started with foster placement so she could move in with me before kindergarten. She had to adjust to a new home, new rules, new routines. Meanwhile, I juggled therapy appointments, social worker visits, trauma workshops, court hearings, and learning how to parent. School was especially hard. The Department of Children and Families had shown up at her preschool twice before to take her to a new home. No preparation, no goodbyes, none of her belongings. She was terrified it would happen again. Every night I'd tell her, "I love you no matter what." And through that love, through tickles and trust and time, we became mother and daughter. Dealing with the child welfare system was confusing, exhausting, and often dehumanizing. It was clarifying, too. I saw the broken system, the kids needing consistent advocates to get their needs met. In August 2024, I officially got a daughter. A brave, anxious, deeply sentimental little girl who is fiercely herself. For that, I'm endlessly grateful. That's not to say life is easy now. As a single mom, I can't just pop out for errands, and dating means scheduling a babysitter. Today, my 9-year-old is hilarious, theatrical, a clever problem solver, and the owner of a fabulous belly laugh. Each day, our home fills with more joy and more love, and an occasional meltdown. Last year, we went to a shelter, hoping for a kitten, but a 2-year-old cat warmed to her right away. We brought Panda home and took our time making him feel secure. One day, I overheard my daughter whisper, "Panda, this is your home now. We love you, no matter what." From Yahoo Health, practice habit stacking. Eat more cabbage and see if your partner passes the bird test. Plus 8 more health tips to help you have a great week. Try standing in line without checking your phone to give your brain a break. By Rachel Grumman Bender. Hi, Yahoo readers. My name is Rachel Grumman Bender, and I've rounded up your wellness tips for a healthier and happier week ahead. A great place to start is habit stacking. Pairing a habit that's already part of your daily routine with another new small task. It's a very practical way to turn an intention into something people can actually do. Dr. Eve Glazier, physician and president of the UCLA Health Faculty Practice Group, tells the Washington Post. For example, I wanted to meditate more often to de-stress, but I could rarely find the time. So I started anchoring the practice to something I was already doing several times a week, exercise. Now, after I finish an at-home workout, I tack on a quick 5 or 10 minute guided meditation. It can be that simple. Want to get a bit more organized? Write down your top 3 priorities the moment you sit down at your desk, linking the 2 habits. Want better balance? Try adding standing on one leg to your toothbrushing routine. Or do it while waiting for your coffee to brew. Whatever combo you choose, staying consistent helps these new routines become automatic over time. Before you figure out which healthy combos to stack, it's always a good idea to check your local forecast. And you might as well glance at your horoscope, too. Then choose one small thing to get healthier and happier. Eat cabbage. It may not be the sexiest vegetable, but cabbage is apparently having a moment, according to the Washington Post. Pinterest even crowned it the new kitchen champ for 2026. That may be because cabbage contains fiber and vitamins C and K. Fermented cabbage in particular, whether that's sauerkraut or kimchi, is especially good for gut health since it's rich in probiotics. If you only use cabbage for slaw, you might be missing out. There are lots of ways to include the vegetable in recipes, like roasted cabbage steaks with garlic breadcrumbs. Don't sit on the toilet for more than 5 minutes. It might be tempting to take your phone to the bathroom, to scroll on social media, or play a quick game, but experts advise against it. The habit can keep you sitting on the toilet longer than you should. Prolonged sitting on an unsupported seat increases blood flow and pressure in the rectal area, which can lead to hemorrhoids. You shouldn't sit on the toilet for more than 5 minutes, Dr. Waka Qureshi, a gastroenterologist at Baylor College of Medicine, tells NBC News. But if you can't live without your smartphone for a few minutes, Qureshi recommends setting a timer. And if constipation is to blame for the lengthy toilet time, try eating more fiber, something most people don't get enough of. See if your partner passes the bird test. How well does your partner pay attention to the little things you're interested in? There's a TikTok trend that puts it to the test. Casually point out something small, like a bird you spotted while you're walking with your partner. Or, if you're walking alone, mention it to your significant other later. Yahoo creator Tamara Gain says, "The point isn't the bird. It's about how your partner responds to that small bid for connection." While the test is far from comprehensive, it can be a quick measure of emotional closeness. Long-term studies have found that couples who consistently responded to those bids tended to stay together, while those who ignored them were more likely to drift apart, notes Gain. Do a standing calf stretch. You probably don't give your calf muscles much thought, but here's why they deserve some attention. They act like a second heart, reports Woman and Home, pumping blood from your lower legs back up to the heart and keeping circulation flowing. Calf stretches help to improve efficiency and flexibility while reducing tension in these muscles. Try this. Stand facing a wall or hold on to a sturdy chair for balance. Step 1 foot forward while keeping your back leg straight and both heels on the floor. Gently lean forward until you feel a good stretch in your calf. Hold for 20 to 30 seconds, then switch legs. Repeat 2 to 3 times per leg. Add a pop of color to your meals. Want an easy way to eat more fruits and vegetables? Add some color to most of your meals and snacks. And no, bright orange Cheeto puffs don't count. If your baseline is no color, start with one meal or snack per day and work your way up. Registered dietitian nutritionist Dana Angelo White tells Real Simple. Top your yogurt with a cup of blueberries. Add beets to your salad. Stir some baby spinach into your pasta. Chop bell peppers and tomatoes and mix them into scrambled eggs. And it doesn't have to be fresh produce only. White says frozen, canned, or dried are perfectly good forms of fruit and vegetables too. Mark friends and family's important events on your calendar. Small gestures go a long way. In her newsletter, writer Anna Newton shared her favorite hacks for life, including jotting down the meaningful events of close friends and family. Not just big ones like birthdays and anniversaries in your calendar. Has your mate got an interview? Important appointment? Big presentation? If you know the date, add it to your diary and send them a little, hope it goes well, thinking of you, message on that day. Honestly, when people remember things like that, my heart sings. Put some good karma out into the world. Prioritize sleep to help lower dementia risk. Many people fall short on sleep, myself included. But here's another reason to make it a priority. After reviewing 69 studies, researchers found that getting 7 to 8 hours of shut-eye at night appears to be the sweet spot for lowering dementia risk, reports Science Alert. Moving your body more also helps. The research found that sitting for more than 8 hours a day and getting less than 150 minutes of exercise per week was associated with a higher dementia risk. Skip the paper receipts. You might want to pass on that paper receipt at checkout. Most are printed on thermal paper coated with BPS, bisphenol S, or BPA, bisphenol A, which are hormone disrupting chemicals that transfer to your skin when you handle receipts. And using a hand sanitizer beforehand can increase the amount absorbed. While touching the occasional receipt isn't likely to pose a major risk, Yahoo creator Caitlin Nagy says there are simple ways to cut down exposure. Opt for a digital receipt that can be emailed or texted to you. If that's not an option, fold the receipt so the printed side faces inward and wash your hands right after. Exercise your way to better cholesterol. Speaking of moving your body, improve your cholesterol by exercising for at least 120 minutes each week, or 30 minutes 4 days a week. Brisk walking, running, high intensity interval training, swimming or cycling showed the biggest impact. But strength training is also important since it can improve triglycerides, HDL levels, and overall body composition. Lisa Young, a registered dietitian, nutritionist, and adjunct professor of nutrition at New York University, tells USA Today, "Want even better results? Do a combo of strength training and cardio. Stand in line without checking your phone." Boredom is something most people try to avoid, and smartphones have made that super easy. But being bored temporarily is actually underrated. It can spark creativity, improve focus, and give your brain a break. Cognitive neuroscientist Julie Frantantoni, who writes the Better Brain newsletter, suggests this simple shift. The next time you're waiting in line, just stand there instead of automatically reaching for your phone. If you have a short break between meetings, try sitting in silence and letting your mind wander. These small margins are important opportunities for your brain to rest, recharge, and consolidate information, Frantantoni writes. We've lost the ability to be bored, and with it, the space your brain needs to stay healthy. returning to the New York Times. Put a cake in a cup, and people line up. An $11 confection called a dot cake seems made for the TikTok era. By Gabriella Gershenson. The line starts as early as 6 a.m. and goes around the block. People wait for hours in the rain. Some of them cry when it doesn't work out. Online, millions tune into videos for the pretty colors and distinct sounds. The frenzy is all for a few spoonfuls of dessert in a cup, known as the dot cake, a simple confection topped with frosting and nonpareil sprinkles, exported from Long Island to Butterfield market locations in New York. It tastes a lot like a cake from a mix. People say it's just a cake and sprinkles because it is just a cake and sprinkles, said Alex Posner, 27, an owner of the Dot Cakes, a bakery in Roslyn, New York, who created the baked good and sells it to Butterfield. Simple as they are, over the last month, dot cakes have exploded into a social media phenomenon. There are customized dot cakes for life events like weddings, engagements, and bar mitzvahs, and for every Hallmark holiday. There are copycats from other bakeries and grocery stores. Already there are endless interpretations. Dot cake ice cream, donuts, bagels, and even manicures. On a recent Friday afternoon at the Long Island Bakery, Jonathan Least, 21, of Plainview, New York, and Jenna Velez, 21, of East Northport, New York, were in line with about 24 people. The pair had organized a day of TikTok tourism. They reminisced about viral foods of yore, like unicorn frappuccinos from Starbucks and crumble cookies. We used to wait on lines much longer than this, Least said. Those who manage to acquire one are often eager to recreate what has become a dot cake cliche, running a spoon over the hard, sprinkle-paved surface, ooing at the sound, then digging into the individually portioned desserts, which come in vanilla, chocolate, red velvet, vanilla chocolate chip, and funfetti. They seem tailor-made for the TikTok era, with their tidy circle of colorful packed sprinkles and the teeth-cracking crunch that serves as kind of ASMR. There's nostalgic familiarity of a classic frosted cake, and if you'd rather not wait in line, it's easy enough to make at home, and perhaps more cost-effective. Dot cakes cost $8 a cup in Roslyn, $11 in Manhattan. It's a multi-sensory experience, said Alexa Matthews, a food influencer and director of the marketing at Butterfield Market, the only retailer in the city that sells the dot cakes products. She added, that's what's taking it to the next level. Butterfield Market, an upscale grocer, often sells foods that are trendy or become internet sensations. Think $300 crown melons from Japan, or its soft-serve frozen yogurt. The store has given cake samples to some content creators, which may have pushed the popularity of the dot cake over the edge. Are they worth the hype? Everyone online just said it tastes like Betty Crocker. The influencer Lucy Rochnebel said in a recent video where she recreated a version at home. There's a little bit of an eye roll element to the fact that this cake went viral, said Carmel Hagen, founder of the baking ingredient company Supernatural. But it may be traveling widely because it's not tricky to do yourself. You don't find that many people making their own cronut, Hagen said. The most polarizing aspect of the dot cake may be the type of sprinkle that has catapulted to fame alongside it. It's not the soft sprinkle or jimmy that has graced many an ice cream cone or funfetti cake. It's not the nonpareil, the hard round bauble that was previously a wallflower of the baking aisle. Rainbow soft sprinkles from Supernatural are typically Amazon's bestseller in the desserts sprinkles category. But for 5 days in May, Hagen said, the brand's nonpareils took that spot. Before dot cakes became a social media phenomenon, Hagen said, they rarely broke the top 20. Nonpareils are an inferior sprinkle, said Molly Yeh, a cookbook author and TV host who uses sprinkles in many of her recipes. They're just kind of overly crunchy and don't have that much flavor. She prefers the softer, chewy kind. A frosted cake with sprinkles is not so novel. Online commenters have pointed out the similarities between dot cakes and a Mexican cortadillo, a simple cake with pink frosting and nonpareil sprinkles. For years, such cakes have been mainstays of celebrations of college acceptance. Posner sells around 3,000 dot cups a week, plus 50 to 70 custom orders each day, including some painstaking designs, and has at least 100 colors of sprinkles to choose from. When she started dot cakes in 2017 as a high school student working out of her parents' home, the point wasn't the cake, it was the decoration, she said, citing pointillism and its totemic artist, Georges Seurat, as an inspiration. And now, the point is the cake. From People, Places, Things. Introducing Naomi Aki by Olivia Ovenden. Growing up in London, the actress Naomi Aki was so shy that her family didn't realize she could sing until they saw her in a preschool production, in a school production of Lionel Bart's 1960 musical, Oliver, when she was 15. I was belting out these huge songs, and they were in so much shock, she says from her home in southwest London. I was like, look, when you guys leave the house, the walls tremble. As soon as you're back, I'm quiet as a mouse. For Aki, 34, acting has always offered a controlled space in which she could transcend her natural timidity. I could be assertive, she says. I felt very immersed in the moment between action and cut. Still, her best performances tend to be understated. Her first major role after graduating from London's Royal Central School of Speech and Drama in 2012 was a terrified, silent housemaid in the movie director William Allroyd's 2016 Lady Macbeth. Earlier this year, she won an Independent Spirit Award for her portrayal of Lydie in Eva Victor's crushing indie film, Sorry, Baby. She plays her character, the best friend of a woman coming to terms with a sexual assault, with a quiet, unwavering kindness that seems to glow from within. Directors, she admits, always have to tell me to speak up. I never want to add anything that feels superfluous. I think it's because part of me is just a bit embarrassed to be an actor. This month, however, Aki is taking on a bolder role in the director Boots Riley's absurdist sci-fi film, I Love Boosters, about thieves who steal luxury clothes to sell at affordable prices to working-class people. She signed on, she says, in part because of the movie's anti-capitalist message. It's about community and fighting the man. Later this year, she'll play the female lead, a Dr. Frankenstein-esque biotech CEO in DC Studios' Clayface. Together, the two projects could add up to a breakthrough moment for the actress. But after her turn as Whitney Houston in the 2022 biopic, I Wanna Dance with Somebody, failed to yield the reception it promised, she now approaches hype with caution. I cannot and will not put myself under that much pressure for a job ever again, she says. The outcome is the outcome, but the buildup and subsequent letdown, while disappointing, ultimately empowered her. Acting doesn't scare me right now, which is interesting, she says. I like feeling a little scared. And that brings us to the end of the program. I'm Mary Ellen. Thank you for joining me. And please join me again for the Women's Hour.
This is Bird Note. The Mississippi kite is one of America's most elegant raptors, with long pointed wings and buoyant flight. These dove gray birds spend their summer hunting over plains and woodlands in southern United States. They often nest colonially, unusual for hawks, with a half dozen pairs in sight of one another in a grove of tall trees. By nesting in groups, they can work together to mob an approaching predator. Medium-sized and large insects dominate the kite's diet. During the breeding season, they seek varied prey from treetops to ground, even over water. But in migration, they become more focused. By late August, the birds come together in flocks and start down the east side of Mexico, joining with tens of thousands of other migrants in the famous River of Raptors. But not only raptors. Green darners, big blue and green dragonflies, emerge from wetlands all over eastern North America and also head south to breed. On their trail are the Mississippi kites, dining on the wing, sustained by the insects that are their traveling companions. Today's show is dedicated to the memory of Rusty Rose, a great friend to birds everywhere, including a group of Mississippi kites he followed, watched, and protected on his ranch in Texas. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
Listeners, would you like to hear news from Holden, Paxton, Princeton, Rutland, and Sterling that you're not likely to hear on commercial television and radio? Tune in to Audio Journal every Friday at 7 a.m. and again at 9 a.m. Thank you for listening to Audio Journal.